It's not particularly on point, but it's such a wonderful message for us, and one that, again, I don't think that we've really understood how great our God is and how superior He is, not only in who He is, but His thoughts are above our thoughts, as this verse says. In Isaiah 55:8-9, again it says, "For my thoughts," God is speaking, He says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, and neither are your ways my ways, declares Yahweh. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." And let me ask you, would you have it any other way? Yeah, who would want to have the gods of some of these other people? You know, they've got Him all figured out. Ours is still beyond our comprehension. We can look forward to the day when He allows us to become like Him and we know all things as He knows. But until then, let's once again never get static with where we're at. That's the problem. That's one of the major problems with the churches today. You know, most of Judeo-Christianity are not cults. But there's hardly one of them that isn't cultic. And most of you know that because you were once on the inside and now you're on the inside looking out. Or on the outside looking in, excuse me. Yeah, because they don't dare, you can't dare go beyond their parameters. And we've got to be careful ourselves that we don't allow ourselves to become cultic as well. That we realize truth is always paramount no matter where it leads us. Now, again, this message is rehashed for a lot of you, but again, hopefully you'll learn something, and we're not necessarily going to talk about something new, but stay open to anything where God would lead you, so long as it's according to His Word and His Spirit. How many of you have heard of Jim Johnson? Well, a bank manager once saw a new young employee eagerly counting $100 bills, and he was impressed with the young man's industry and his enthusiasm. He said, "Where'd you get your financial education?" And the young man said, "From Yale." The bank manager said, "Well, great." He said, "What's your name?" He said, "Jim Johnson." Now that one will get by you. You got to think about it. His name was Jim Johnson, and he got his financial education in Yale. This one's maybe a little easier. There was a newly appointed young minister once that was new to the town and was asked to do a funeral service. Or not actually a funeral service, but to just do a graveside little thing for the fellow who had died. No family and no one was going to be there. And so he'd started out earlier, and after several wrong turns in town, he finally found his way to the funeral or to the cemetery, and was about a half an hour late. And the hearse was gone, and nobody was there. The workers were under a tree eating their lunch, and he thought, "Well, they'll go over, and I can still do the little service." And he went over and looked into the grave, and did his little few minute thing, and said amen, prayed, and said amen, started walking away. And one of the workers under the tree said, "Should we tell that guy that's a septic tank?" Now that's just hopefully get us started so that we're not going to fall asleep here too quickly. But also, those two stories are for anyone who hasn't yet figured out that identity is important. What a word, identity. You know, what they have done with that word, and that's all it is. It's just a simple word called identity. No more different than those two stories, that identity is important. Those two stories illustrate that identity is important, but how much more important when it comes to who's who in the Bible? The second law of hermeneutics, according to most people in their teaching on hermeneutics, is to correctly understand who the author was writing to. If you don't have the author figured out, and you don't have who he's writing to figured out, you haven't even got you haven't got to second base. You maybe got to first base. You've got the author, at least the supreme author, figured out. But if you don't know who they were writing to, you haven't got to second base yet. And it's no wonder, again, there have been so many mistakes as a result of that. This will be Judah, Israel, and the Gentiles, Yahweh's escorts through the Bible. Now, having established the biblical identity of the Judahites and Israelites, again, Judahites, as we should all know, are Israelites, but not all Israelites are Judahites. We can now proceed with that understanding to the biblical identity of the people in the Bible known as the Gentiles. And we hopefully laid the groundwork in the latter part of the last message to lay the groundwork in order to go where we need to go with this. We've already seen that there's, of course, a lot of confusion in the religious world today regarding the Judahites and the Israelites in the Bible. But let me tell you, there's a whole lot more confusion when it comes to the Gentiles. And part of the problem is they haven't figured out the Judahites and the Israelites yet. They get that figured out, that lays the groundwork for correctly understanding the Gentiles. But there's much more confusion on the Gentiles than I think there is on the Judahites and the Israelites. Could some of the Gentiles in the Bible actually be someone other than whom they are commonly thought to be? You know, everybody believes that they're this particular people. And again, there's even truth in who they think they are, isn't there? When you start to understand the words and the Hebrew word goy or goyim or the Greek word ethnos or ethne. And there's actually truth in, you know, I'm a Gentile. We're going to find out even that statement's not biblically correct, but there is a grain of truth, and they don't even realize when they claim to be that who they're claiming to be. If it's true that the Gentiles are someone other than whom they're commonly believed to be, it would mean that most of the main characters, the three primary cast of characters in the Bible, are someone other than whom nearly everyone today in the church world believes them to be. And with that in mind, how in the world can it be other than what we have out there in the Judeo-Christian world today, which is best described as Babel or confusion? If you haven't got that figured out, if you've got everybody, the three primary characters in the Bible mixed up, there can be nothing but confusion based upon that. Now, to answer the previous question, a person has to become familiar with two words, one Hebrew and one Greek. The English word Gentiles in the Old Testament, if you're not familiar with this, is translated from the Hebrew word or the Hebrew singular word goy and the plural word goyim. It's goy in the singular, goyim in the plural. And the New Testament counterpart to that Greek word in the singular is ethnos, and in the plural it's ethne. Now the Hebrew words goy and goyim are found in the King James Old Testament 557 times. Now catch this. The first part of this you may have heard before, but I don't know if you've added the last part of this. It's found 557 times in the Old Testament. They are translated nations 373 times, heathens 142 times, Gentiles 30 times, peoples 11 times, and another one time. However, not even once is it translated as goy or goyim, translated as non-Jew or non-Israelite, like nearly everyone today in Christendom interprets it. Not once is it ever translated in that fashion. The Greek words, ethnos and ethne, are found in the King James 166 times. They're translated Gentiles 93 times, nations 64 times, heathens 5 times, peoples 2 times, Greeks 1 time, and most people don't add this, but believe it or not, it's even translated saint 1 time, and I'm not sure why they did that, but it's in there. However, once again, not even once is it ever translated as non-Jew or non-Israelite, the way that the majority interpret it. Now, because some people think that the Jews, and this is why the former groundwork was so important, but because some people think that the Jews in the Bible represent all 12 tribes, they inevitably then have to jump to the conclusion that the term Gentiles, especially when used in contrast to the Jews, has to exclusively refer to non-Israelites. Here's some examples. I'll give you some following quotations just as examples of this thinking. The Westminster Dictionary of the Bible. Some of these sources may have some things right, but let me guarantee you they got a lot of things wrong too, so you've got to sort through it. But the Westminster's Dictionary of the Bible, 1944, page 119, under the heading Gentiles, it defines it as Gentiles, all nations of the world other than the Jews. That sounds pretty common, right? Fawcett's Bible Dictionary, 1963, page 316, under the heading Gentiles, nations or heathens as opposed to Israel. Of course, when they use the word Israel, they're thinking Jews. Here's Tim LaHaye out of Will You Escape the Tribulation Again, 1998, page 233. Quote, Gentiles, all the peoples of the world who are non-Jews. In the New Testament, a Gentile designates any lost member of the human race who is not a Jew. End of quote. And then one more, Anton Darms, and who's the most emphatic that I've ever seen on this, in his book, The Delusion of British Israelism, published in 1940 on pages 72 and 73, stated the following, a lot of this in caps. He said, the term Gentiles in the New Testament always refers to people and nations outside of and apart from all 12 tribes of Israel. A little later, he says, it can be said positively in no case in the Bible, either in the Old Testament or in the New, does the word Gentile refer or apply to any part of Israel? End of quote. Never read the Bible, I don't think, very closely. And of course, again, because they've already concluded that the Jews equal all 12 tribes of Israel, what other conclusion can they come to? Again, it's not so much what you don't know that concerns me, but what you think you know that you don't. The fact is, the word Gentiles, goy, ethnos, or their plural forms, are not the exclusionary terms as that most people today think that they are. For example, try replacing the word nations, translated from goyim, with the word non-Israelites in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 23, where Rebekah was informed about her twin boys, Isaac and Jacob, and see how much sense it makes. I'll give it to you. And Yahweh said unto her, two non-Israelites are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. Doesn't work. And yet that's how, I mean, that's the inevitable conclusion, or the where you have to take the thinking of today's Christianity. Let me give you another one. Replace the word nation with, again, translated from Goyim, with non-Israelites in Genesis 48:19, where Jacob blesses his second son Ephraim. Here's how it read. And his father, Jacob, refused and said, I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great, and truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of non-Israelites. One more, especially this one. Replace the word nation with non-Israelite in Jeremiah 31, 35 through 36. One of my favorite passages, where Yahweh promised both houses that he would have a relationship with them as long as the sun rules by day and the moon rules by night. Here's what it says, and here's how it would read. Thus saith Yahweh, which giveth the sun for light by day, and the ordinance of the moon and the stars, for a light by night, which divideth the sea, when the waves thereof roar. Yahweh of hosts is his name. And then it says, if those ordinances depart from before me, saith Yahweh, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being non-Israelites before me forever. You talk about nonsensical. Again, the information I don't think is new to probably anybody in here. But hopefully maybe some of that's something that can be used, I think. You know, the next time they say that the Gentiles are non-Israelites, take them to Jeremiah 31. Say, here's the word that's translated, Goyim. Let's put non-Israelites in here. And Yahweh then said to the seed of Israel, also, or they shall also cease from being non-Israelites before me forever. You know, I think, you know, what we see today in the world today is the fulfillment of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. If you're not familiar with them, the 1897, it was the minutes from the first Zionist Congress held in Basel, Switzerland. And if nothing else proves them true, that one statement where they stated that they would dumb down the Goyim, thank you, since I know who the Goyim are, but they'd dumb down the Goyim to the place where they could no longer think except by the promptings of their specialists, proves them those protocols as being true, if nothing else doesn't. And of course, there's so much more that does. But you know what? Catch that statement. He said that we will dumb down the Goyim to the place where they can no longer think except by the promptings of our specialists. You know what? I think we can become the specialists. We've just got to learn to ask the right questions and share the right kind of information. That passage is one of them, and that idea. All of a sudden they're going, yeah, that doesn't, I mean, they aren't going to argue with that. They're going to say, yeah, that doesn't work, does it? And all of a sudden you've opened up just a little light in a very darkened brain in this day and age, that all of a sudden, once that light starts to shine, isn't that how it was with you? I remember that's how it was with me, Hebrews 8:8. You know, when I was first pointed out that Hebrews 8:8, the new covenant was made of the house of Israel and the house of Judah, and verse 9 says it was with those who were the descendants of those whom Moses led by the hand out of Egypt, and I'd always interpreted it as the church, spiritual Israel. I thought, how in the world could I have missed that? And it was the seed. It took 2 years for it to finally come to complete fruition. And it was the story about the Gentiles in Hosea 1 and 2 that finally was the final piece of the puzzle for me. But if we can just get that little spark of light, if we can learn to ask the right questions and make the right kind of comments and use the right kind of information, I think we can reach out to them and we can win them. Don't force feed them, and don't feed the whole bale of hay all at one time. I mean, that's not how it worked for you. It's not going to work for them that way. And so start with a little bit. Be patient and plant the right kinds of seed. Now, the preceding examples in those passages, and you can do it who knows how many times in the Old Testament, do the same thing. But the preceding examples demonstrate that the definition and the application for the Hebrew word goyim is not narrow as some people have tried to make it. The same is true for its Greek counterpart, the Greek word ethnos or ethne. If modern Christianity's, and just a real quick, another quick example here, if modern Christianity's definition of those two Greek words is true, then John 18:35 would have to be rendered in the following fashion. Pilate answered, "Am I a Judahite? Thine own Gentile and chief priest have delivered thee unto me, and what hast thou done?" Of course, it doesn't make any more sense in those Old Testament passages. You can do the same thing with the New Testament as well. The fact is, ethnos and ethne, again, have a much broader application in the New Testament as well than is commonly understood. Now, I won't take the time to go and look these up with you, but let me give you some examples, and you can do this on your own. For example, in Acts 17, much broader definition than just non-Israelites. Does the word ethne and ethnos and goyim and goy sometimes refer to non-Israelites? Sure it does. Ethne and ethnos, New Testament. For example, in Acts chapter 17, verses 44 through 45, the word Gentiles, translated from the Greek word ethne, is used there, again you can look at these up on your own, is used there in reference to non-Israelites, specifically Canaanites. No question about that. But in Acts 17:26, the word nations, also translated from ethne, is used in reference to a multi-ethnic multitude of people, both Israelites and non-Israelites. All of a sudden, the New Testament application of those words has got just a little bit wider than what most people want to limit it to. And then in Acts 10:22, the word nation, translated from ethnos, is used in reference to Israelites exclusively, specifically descendants of the house of Judah. And that's done at least three times in the New Testament where ethnos is used for the house of Judah. And then finally in Romans 9:23-24, the word Gentiles, translated from ethne, is used in reference to Israelites, and in this case, specifically, descendants of the house of Israel. Now we'll return to that last passage a little bit later in this message, because some people will question the application of that particular passage. The other three, when you point out to them as ethne, and they can read the context for themselves, there will be no argument that in one case it's dealing with non-Israelites, the second case is dealing with non-Israelites and Israelites alike, and the third case is dealing with Judahites. Now the fourth one, they'll maybe question. We'll come back to it for that reason, and also because it provides some important clues for solving the mystery of the Gentiles. In fact, it was the passage that opened up the final piece of the puzzle for me to see what I now see. However, even without accepting that application of the word ethnos in Romans 9:23-24, it should already be apparent, and again, it is already apparent for you, but speaking to those whom you shared this with, it should then become apparent with those whom you would share those examples with from those three other passages, as well as others. I mean, that's just a sampling. As well as others in the New Testament, that there is, again, a much broader use for the word, the Greek words ethnos and ethne, which are usually translated Gentiles, than is usually taught in most churches today. This is further demonstrated by the Greek lexicographers, who provide, again, the broader application. They can go to their resource books again, and the information is right there. Now, because of time, I won't quote these, but you'll find that true, for example, in both Joseph Thayer's Greek English lexicon. Look up the word Gentiles, and you'll find that he applies it to Israelites. And also in Gerhard Kittel's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, Volume 2 on page 103-369, you'll find the same thing. The explanation, the biblical definition of that word as it should be given. You may not find it in the churches today very often, but you'll find it again in some of their resource works. And it's no different in the Old Testament. Goy, the Hebrew equivalent of the Greek ethnos, is used once again in identical fashion. Consider the following definition. This is one I did want to share with you. For the word goy, this comes from the New Brown Driver Briggs Jacinius Hebrew English Lexicon. Defining goy, here's what it says. Number one, nation, people, a little bit later, specifically of descendants of Abraham. Genesis 12:2 and 17:6. Definitely, of Israel. Now, I'm skipping some stuff in this definition just for the, because it's not important here, but specifically of the descendants of Abraham, gives the passages, definitely of Israel, Exodus 19:6, 33:13, Deuteronomy 4:6, and Israel and Judah as two nations, as Ezra 35:10. Usually, it goes on, of non-Hebrew peoples. But notice it didn't say exclusively, like everybody else is telling you today. Usually of non-Hebrew peoples, and it gives some passages for that. Now listen to me. The Old Testament does not, and again, you're probably already there, does not use the word goy or goyim exclusively for non-Israelite peoples. In fact, this lexicon begins by correctly defining these terms as any nation or people. And that includes those three definitions I just shared with you that many Christians are completely oblivious to. That is, that the goy can refer specifically to the descendants of Abraham, definitely of Israel, and of Israel and Judah as two nations. Very important keys, and again, I'm sure you're already aware of this. And get this. This you may not know. I've never seen this brought out anywhere else. But get this. Both Moses and Ezekiel. Now, keeping in mind the usual definition for goy and goyim. Exclusively, non-Israelites, right? Keeping that in mind, get this. Moses and Ezekiel record non-Israelites identifying Israelites as goyim. Talk about a wrench in their theology. And you can look these up again yourself. Deuteronomy 4, 5 through 7, Moses does so. And in Ezekiel 35, 10, Ezekiel does too. Identifies non-Israelites identifying Israelites as goyim. Nelson's New Illustrated Bible Dictionary points out that the word Gentiles is, quote, a term used by Jewish people, contemporary Jewish people, now catch this, to, quote, refer to foreigners or any other people who were not a part of the Jewish race, end of quote. Now, does that sound familiar? It sounds exactly what the pulpits today are spouting. That could not have been said better. Most, if you were to ask the vast majority of today's pulpits what the definition of the word Gentiles is, it couldn't be said better than that. Where did that come from? That came from Nelson's New Illustrated Bible Dictionary. In other words, Nelson's New Bible Dictionary is admitting that the idea, and this is important, that the idea that the term Gentiles exclusively means non-Israelites or non-Jews is simply a modern Jewish tradition. That's where it came from. Adopted by modern Christianity. What did Christ say about the tradition of the Jews or the Judaizers? Beware. The fact is that both non-Israelite and Israelite goy can be found in the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament alike. The reason being, the Hebrew word goy, like the Greek word ethnos, is simply a generic word meaning nations or peoples. The most cogent definition comes from, my opinion, Newther's Greek English Lexicon on page 168. It says it defines it as simply a multitude of individuals from the same nature or genus. That's what it means. It's the word just like our word nation. Nations is clearly the best translation of both the Hebrew word goy and the Greek word ethnos. And therefore, both words should have been consistently translated that way throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament alike. Permitting the context, just like we did in those other examples, permitting the context to of each passage to determine what particular nations it's referring to. Israelites, non-Israelites, Philistines, Edomites, or whatever it would be. Had goy and ethnos been translated in that fashion, had they consistently been translated nations, I assure you that much of today's confusions concerning the Gentiles and concerning Israel would have never occurred. It was because of the translators and what they did. Now, I don't know if there's any King James onlyers here or not, as I would call them. My intention is not to step on toes, but I guarantee the King James doesn't have this right any better than the New American Standard or the NIV or anywhere else. There is no perfect translation. Do we have God's revealed word? Yes. We just don't have it in any one particular translation. I use the King James when I'm preaching, but I certainly don't limit myself to just that. I try to go back to the Greek and the Hebrew as much as you can. And if you won't, then you're not going to be able to make the conclusions that I've just shared with you about these Hebrew and Greek words. You have to go back to the Greek and the Hebrew. And of course, that inconsistency, the real regrettable part about that inconsistency in the translation of just those two Hebrew, that one Hebrew word and that one Greek word, has consequently resulted in some very tragic, flawed theology concerning these words and their biblical applications and the eschatology that has gone wild with the Israelis over there. All because, again, of that problem with those words. Furthermore, and I made the statement earlier, I said it wasn't even correct, but furthermore, people are often heard speaking of an individual being a Gentile. Maybe had somebody come up to you and say, well, I'm a Gentile. You know, they're Jews and I'm a Gentile. Well, linguistically, that is also a misuse of the word. Because the word goy, both the words goy and ethnos in the Bible are collective nouns. Neither word, and therefore neither word, can be used to identify an individual. Nobody can be a Gentile. It's impossible. Not according to the Bible. They're collective nouns. The Bible always uses those terms to identify a nation composed of many individuals or many nations, but never one individual. So if anybody ever says, well, I'm a Gentile to you, you've got an open door to start sharing some truth with them, because they cannot be. You can tell them there ain't no such critter, if you want to do it cowboy, the cowboy talk. Now, with all of this information, you know, you've got to wonder, all of this information, truly, so readily available in the Word of God and in the lexicons and these other source books that I've quoted, you've got to wonder, why is it then that preachers and theologians continue to teach otherwise? Well, at the best, and I think sometimes we're too critical of our brethren. Sometimes we forget where we came from. But at the best, they simply haven't had the opportunity to investigate this particular area yet. Now, if that's the case, and they're an acquaintance of yours, maybe the problem isn't with them, but with you. That they haven't had the chance yet because you haven't given it to them. You may be the only one who knows this information, and therefore the only one that has the ability. By the way, and I was sharing this with Jerry over at lunch, that, you know, a lot of our people, I see this continually over the years, and how people, nearly every time I go somewhere, somebody will comment the fact how discouraging it is that you plant seeds and it seems like none of it ever comes to fruit, or very little of it. You know, I think the day is coming where we're going to see that change. I think 9/11 proves the point. Don't get discouraged. You know, our job, first of all, is not to bring the increase anyway. It's just to be throwing the seed out there. And don't get, you know, too often we don't see the results, immediate or results soon to come, and we get discouraged and we throw in the seed. Hey, our job is just to throw the seed. Just get it throwing out there. And I believe the day is that seed you have planted and you plant today is going to come to fruit. Now, 9/11 proved a couple things. One, judgment works. What did the people do after 9/11? They immediately started flocking back to the churches. Now, it also proves this, regrettably. It also proves how bad it's got, how much worse judgment has got to be to stick. Because it only lasted 2 or 3 weeks. So we've got some more big-time judgment coming. I think that was just a prelude. But judgment works. And the people are going to, when judgment really comes down upon this nation, regrettably, like we deserve, the people are going to flock back to the churches. But when they go back to the churches, they're going to find out the churches don't have any answers. In fact, a good portion of them are going to say, why are you coming to us? We thought we'd be raptured out of this mess. What do you think we have answers for? You know, then you know what's going to happen. They're going to say, you know what? I remember Tom saying something to me years ago, or John, or whoever it might have been, saying it made sense, and I just kind of brushed it off. And I think in that day and age, when they find there's no answers out there, they're going to come and look into the right place. Not that we've got them on, and God forbid that we ever think that we do. But we've got some of them because He's given them to us. So don't get discouraged with that. But you got to wonder, why in the world with all this here? Well, part of the reason may be that, again, at the best, that they haven't had the opportunity, and that's our fault. At the worst, they're similar to the leaders described in Ezekiel chapter 22 and verse 25. And that verse says, there is a conspiracy in her, the land's prophets. There is a conspiracy in her prophets. They have taken the treasure and the precious things. End of quote. And then giving, that they have taken them and given them away to someone whom they have, that they do not belong. Isn't that what they've done? They've taken the treasure that belongs to Israel when she comes back to her God and not before. We don't deserve anything before we come back to the cross. But that belongs to those Israelites who have come back to the cross through Christ. They have taken that and they've given it to the imposters who are trampling it all underfoot. The question that Christians are or let me put it this way, our intention should be that we get them to ask at some point in some fashion in the way that we present our message. We need to be getting them to ask the question of whether they're going to believe those who, again, are further. I'm back on the Gentile specifically issue. Are they going to believe those who are furthering the Jewish tradition that the term Gentiles in the Bible always refers to non-Israelites? Or are you going to? Are they going to believe the inspired writers of both the Old and New Testaments? And that's always what it's got to boil down to. Listen, if they're not interested in truth, then do as Christ said. Brush off your shoes, brush off the dust off your coat, and go find somebody else. Go find some fruitful ground and quit throwing your pearls to the swine that'll just tread it underfoot. But if that's the kind of question that will motivate them, that is it going to be Jewish tradition? Is it going to be? Then you've got the opportunity to go somewhere with that. Understand and accept that Goy and Ethnos refer to both non-Israelites and Israelites alike, and it will, of course, place you well on your way to correctly interpreting both the Scriptures, both Old and New Testament alike. You know, I wish I had the time, and I don't. I wish I had the time to spend some time looking at the testimony of the prophets on this issue. Because it's the prophets, probably more than anything else in the Bible, that testify to today's misuse of the words Goy, Ethnos, and Gentiles. I'm in the midst of writing a book that I believe, and of course I'm the author, I'm probably too close to know for sure, but I believe it has the potential of being more powerful as a witnessing tool than God's covenant people has been. And it's going to be called The Mystery of the Gentiles, Who Are They and Where Are They Now? And most of this material will come from that, and I deal in much more detail in that book with the prophet's testimony as to who the Gentiles are, especially as it relates to the New Testament. You know, most of you know that Romans 11, you know, if you understand this message, man, you talk about thrilling. People like to hear about fulfilled prophecy. Of course, they're looking for it always today, but oftentimes it's right there already been fulfilled in the Bible. It's right there. And it's the testimony that our God is true to His Word. Romans 11, if you haven't figured this out, for just one example, one that really thrills me, I love Romans 11. You know, Romans 11 through 13, before I understood this message, I'd just kind of like to skip over those chapters. Because you talk about confusing if you don't have these three escorts right going through the Bible. But you get these figured out, and all of a sudden those become some of the most exciting chapters in the Bible. And in Romans 11, if you haven't figured this out, Romans 11, when you understand who the Jews are in that passage, Judahites, and who the Gentiles are, the house of Israel in this case, all of a sudden it is the literal fulfillment of the two sticks of Ezekiel 37 that were to be reunited into the one hand of God. You know what? Take the two prophecies of Ezekiel 37. The first prophecy is the dead dry bones that come to life. Then the second prophecy of Ezekiel 37 is the two dead sticks. And it put the two together, and the prophecy was that these two dead sticks representing the house of Israel and the house of Judah would be reunited and brought back to life. What's Romans 11 about? The two living branches, the olive branches. And of course, the term olive tree, olive branches, is used exclusively only for Israelites. And what do you have? You've got the fulfillment of the two that are brought back and unified together. And what do you have? Dead, dry sticks, when brought to life, become what? Two living branches. I don't know if that excites you like it excites me, but when I first was able to figure that one out, it was like, wow, there it is, and how good our God is. And He gives us that kind of insight and to see that He indeed fulfills His word, not only then, but that particular prophecy is being fulfilled every time a Judahite or an Israelite comes to Christ. It's surrenders his life and becomes born again under the blood of Christ. How glorious it is that he made that possible for us. Now, I got to be careful. I don't ad-lib too much, or we're going to be here a whole lot longer than we're planning. Anyway, you start understanding some of that, and it places us well on the way to really interpreting the Bible. It really, as you know, it opens it up. And, you know, if nothing else, I hope I can do this with rehashing old material with you, is to excite you with it again. Now, sometimes it's past history with us, and we kind of lose the excitement with it. I want to try to rekindle the excitement you had when you first understood it yourself. Can you remember that? By the looks of you, it might have been a long time ago. No offense, brother. But go back. Go back and rekindle and get... We need to get excited about it again. And rekindle it so that we won't be discouraged to take it out and teach somebody. And again, don't open the chute gate and run them over. You know, just plant a few seeds. Let it take root and come back and water it a little bit. And you might be amazed, you know. You might have a brother or sister in Christ sitting here right beside you. You know, ready to get excited. Nothing more exciting than new blood. Amen. You know, a lot of you get you around long enough, you know, we all kind of get smelly. You know, metaphorically speaking, of course. But well, maybe in some cases not metaphorically speaking. But you know, new blood is exciting. But we've got to get excited to get the new blood, and we've got to love our brethren enough to go want to do it. Again, I wish I had time to go into the prophets in a lot more detail, but that book, Lord willing, will be available either sometime this year or any year between now and 10 years from now. You know, God's Covenant People was meant to be, initially my idea was for it to be a transcription of a 60-minute message. And 6 or 7 years later, it became what it was. So I'm not guaranteeing when this will be published, but we do hope to publish it later this year. The prophet Amos declared in 3:7 that surely the Lord Yahweh will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants the prophets. And that is precisely where the customary interpretation of the Gentiles falls so woefully short. They have to literally leave prophecies unfulfilled. Ezekiel 37 is a great example of that. They can't identify both groups. If you can't identify both groups in the prophecy, how can you find fulfillment for the prophecy? You know, the Jews represent all Israel. Where's the second group? Where's the second stick? They haven't got it figured out. It falls woefully short when you start going to the prophets. Not only does the generally accepted interpretation of the word Gentiles misuse God's word, but furthermore, it leaves unfulfilled. So much of the scriptures is just unbelievable. Thus far, we have hopefully come to understand, and I know many of you already have, that the term Jews and Judites, again, when referring to genetic Israelites, exclusively represents the descendants of the house of Judah. That the descendants of the house of Israel were never known as Jews or Judahites, and simply as Israelites, and after being divorced, they even lost the right to be called Israel, and they subsequently became generically known as simply the Goyim, or the Ethnos, or the, as it's been tragically translated in our English versions, the Gentiles. However, we can't leave it there, can we? Because at this point, if you leave it there, there are at least two predominant questions that beg to be answered. And that is, who are today's Jews then today? And who represents the nations of Israel today? We haven't even touched upon that. Let's begin, and I'll do this as quickly as possible. Let's begin with today's Jews, today's Israelis, as they're sometimes called. By the way, do you know the difference between an Israeli and an Israelite? Well, there's another difference. Anybody know another difference? Well, the Israelite has 25% less fat. It's also a lie. One of them is a lie as well. Now, I assure you that there's a whole lot more difference between the two, as you know, than just 25% less fat. Now, most people believe that today's Jews are descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that they represent all 12 tribes of the nation of Israel. However, as has already been demonstrated, the second half of that claim cannot be accurate, because the term Jews never, never biblically represented all 12 tribes of Israel. Furthermore, according to even many Jewish authorities, the first half of this claim, that the majority of today's Jews represent the 12 tribes or even two tribes, is admitted by Jewish authorities as also being incorrect. And again, if you can use them, use them. They're a whole lot more likely to believe a Jew for some reason than they are you, or at least me. I know that for sure. For example, many of you know about this. This is to me. I use this in everything I can use it in. I use it because it's a very succinct statement and it says it all. And then you can always, it's like the bait on the hook. If you can hook them with this, and this should get them to go, what? And if you can get them to do that, then you can say, okay, and this is even backed up over here and over here and over here, and then you can give them the rest of the information. But for example, the first chapter of the 1980 Jewish Almanac. Anybody unfamiliar with this? First chapter of the 1980 Jewish Almanac. Now, first of all, it's entitled Identity Crisis. That's the first chapter. The first sentence of that first chapter, entitled Identity Crisis, succinctly presents a fact that the vast majority, again, of Christianity has no clue to. Here's what it says. Quote, strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew. Now, can it be said any better than that? Webpage, which is www.missiontoisrael.org, you'll find links to the that page with an actual reproduction of the first chapter and the first page, not the first chapter, but the first page of the first chapter with that sentence, so that they can look at the Jewish Almanac. Because in putting one of the reasons that God's covenant people took so long is because I was determined to absolutely document that as perfectly as I could, therefore, I would say 90 to 95% of, there's over 700 documented quotes, 95% of those quotes, I either have the books in my library, or if I had the interlibrary loan them in from somewhere, I have photocopies of everything, title page and all the documentation for it. This has been one of the most challenged, this has been the most challenged quote that I have ever had in anything, that people have said, I want to see it. And so there's on several of our books. And by the way, if you go to the webpage, every book that we have published is on the webpage. You can download it. You don't need to pay me for a book. You can get it right off. God's Covenant People, I think, is about three quarters up. We don't have it all up. The only book that we've published that is Christian Duty Under Corrupt Government. But everything that we've published is an earlier version of what was published is up on the webpage. And in several of those, there will be a link that will from quote that I just shared with you to an actual reproduction of the page that you can download and hand to somebody. Or if you don't have internet capabilities, you need it, you call me or write me, and I will photocopy you that material. www.missiontoisrael.org. Yeah, two in there. All right, well, that amazing quotation. Again, that's the one it's so succinct, it says it so well, that's the one I use the most. But that admission is confirmed, of course, by many other Jewish authorities as well. Far too many for me to quote in this message, but let me just read some of these off. The 1905 Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1941 Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1966 Standard Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1971 Encyclopedia Judaica. I just about covered them all, at least the ancient, the older versions. And I've got all of those. We can photocopy things out of that. You're welcome to those as well, if we need to photocopy anything out of that. Also, Bernard Lazare, some of these you might have heard, Robert Quillen, James Yap, Paul Meyer, and many others. Jews and, of course, non-Jews alike have testified to the fact that the majority of today's Jews simply are not Israelites at all. Dr. Oscar Levy, for example, in his book, What Price Israel, published in 1953 on page 223, he went so far as to say, quote, and are not they, speaking of today's Jews, and are not they the inventors of the chosen people myth? End of quote. Again, that's powerful because of who it comes from. It's powerful to begin with, but it's even more powerful because of who those quotes come from. In other words, someone has stolen someone's identity. It kind of reminds me of the story of Sherlock Holmes. I'll just read this one to you because it's a little detailed here and it uses terms that I'm not all that best with being a Western cowboy here. But anyway, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson go on a camping trip, set up their tent, fall asleep. Some hours later, Holmes wakes his faithful friend. He says, "Watson, look up in the sky and tell me what you see." Watson replies, "I see millions of stars." Holmes, what does that tell you? Watson ponders for a minute. He says, "Astronomically speaking, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, it tells me that Saturn is in Leo. Time-wise, it appears to be approximately 3:15. Theologically, it's evident the Lord is all-powerful and we are small and insignificant. Meteorologically, it seems we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. What does it tell you?" Holmes is silent for a moment and then speaks. "Watson, you idiot, someone has stolen our tent." But isn't that about the way it is? You know, everything's being stolen from us and everybody's involved in meteorology and astronomically, and not that those aren't important too, but man, if the tent's God, you better take care of that first. You know, the question that we should be asking is, why in the world has Christendom and the American public not been told that over 90% of today's people known as Jews are not the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but that instead history reveals that they are actually descendants of the, at least this far back, the fierce Turkish, Mongolian, Khazar tribes that roamed the steppes of southern Russia and who adopted the religion of Judaism between the 7th and 9th centuries A.D. I mean, that's facts. Those facts are undeniable. Most of you are familiar with the 13th tribe, written by Arthur Koestler. You probably knew that published in 1976 by Random House Publishers, that it was on the bestsellers list for I forget how many weeks. Did you know the only place you couldn't find it where you should have been able to find it was in the Bible bookstores? That's where it should have been sold. And they wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. In other words, today's Khazars are known as Jews with this understanding, once you understand that they adopted the religion of Judaism and what their heritage is. They are known today as Jews not because of any racial links to Abraham through Isaac and Jacob, but simply because they adopted the religion of the Jews, the religion of Judaism. That's why they're called Jews, and of course, you probably already know that. More importantly, why hasn't modern Christianity believed Yeshua? That's even a more important question. Who forewarned us of Israelite imposters, did he not? You know the passages, Revelations 2:9 and 3:9. For the sake of the tape, Revelations 2:9, "I know thy works and thy tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich, and I know the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan." And Revelations 3:9, nearly a repeat, but a little bit differently. It says, "Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet and know that I have loved thee." Why aren't they believing the Savior they claim? In other words, there were and there are imposters who claim to be Israelites from the house of Judah. They were claiming to be Judahites, and therefore Judahites from the house of Judah. You know, it's very interesting that after quoting, this is again one of those taking it from them and using it for our purposes, but after quoting the previous last scripture, Jewish author Jack Bernstein, in his book, The Life of an American Jew and Racist Marxist Israel, after quoting Revelations 3:9, pointed out to today's Jews that they are, quote, "the people to whom God was referring," end of quote, in Revelations 3:9. Again, excellent quote to use. Say, you don't have to believe me, but you might want to believe them, those you put so much trust and confidence and faith in. Now, it has been well established and documented, mostly by modern Jews themselves, that the vast majority of today's Jews are descendants of Khazars. However, a point even more pertinent, at least to the Bible, is that the Khazars have all the biblical and spiritual marks of Esau Edom's descendants. Now, I didn't know this until just recently, or in the last few years anyway, but the Jewish Encyclopedia, 1905, Volume 4, page 3, under the heading Khazars, recounts a Khazar tradition that originally places their progenitors near the land of Edom. Here's how it reads, quote, Hasadai Ibn Shaprut. If you think you can do better with that, then you just march right up here. Who was, I'm not going to do it again. Who was, I won't get it the same the second time. Who was foreign minister to Abdah al-Razan, Sultan of Cordova, in his letter to King Joseph of the Khazars. And Joseph was the original king of the Khazars in the 7th century AD, who adopted the religion of Judaism. About 960 AD. Speaks of the tradition according to which the Khazars once dwelt near the Seir Mountains. End of quote. Now, if you don't know anything about the Seir Mountains, that wouldn't mean much to anyone. But if you know who Mount Seir and the surrounding country belong to, all of a sudden that comes off that page like, wow, what an admission. Because, of course, Mount Seir and its surrounding area was the Edomites' homeland. Genesis 32:3. Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Furthermore, according to three Jewish encyclopedias and Flavius Josephus, you're probably familiar with these quotes, the Edomites became known as Jews, in name or religion, of course, at the time of the high priest John Hyrcanus Maccabeus. Edom. Let me share these with you. Under the heading Edom, the Encyclopedia Judaica, 1971, volume 6, page 378. Quote, in the days of John Hyrcanus, end of the 2nd century BCE, the Edomites became a section of the Jewish people. Edom, Edomia, under the heading Edom, Edomia, the Jewish Encyclopedia, 1904, volume 5, page 41, says they were incorporated with the Jewish nation. Edom, Edomia, again, the New Standard Jewish Encyclopedia, 1977, page 41, quote, from then on, they constituted a part of the Jewish people, Herod, the king of Judea, being one of their descendants, end of quote. You wonder why he had it out for Christ? Was an Edomite. And if you remember when Rebecca was heavy with those twins, God had told her that there are two people in thy womb that will essentially war with each other from that point on. You know, I'll share this a little bit off point, maybe just a little bit, but I'll share this with you. You know, there was a battle already even in the womb of Rebecca with those two baby boys. And the word that's used, rakhots, I believe it is, rashots or rakhots in the Hebrew, it was the Hebrew word that was used when, in the Old Testament, a man had his head crushed with a rock. The word crushed is the same word that was talked about the battle that was going on in his womb. There was a battle going on in her womb, and so much so that she's thinking, what in the world, ladies, you think you had it tough? This gal's got it tough. You know, and they're battling, she goes to Yahweh, and she says, what in the world's going on? Says you've got two nations that are in your womb battling. Now, do I think they were having a fist fight? I don't think so. You know what I think was happening? I think they were jockeying for the position to be firstborn. I think that's what was happening. It was this big tussle always. It was like it was genetic within them to say it's important that I be firstborn. And the fact that I think the proof of it is in that when Esau was born, here's Jacob still holding on. And ladies, you think it's bad sometimes. This guy had his feet braced, hanging on to old Esau. Doing everything he could. Saying, it ain't going to be you, buddy. And Esau made it out first, but he didn't thwart the plans of our God, thank God. Because if he had, it would have been them and not us. And that's what's happening today. You know, they're claiming to be Israel. You know, I think it's genetic. I think it's in their blood. Whether they realize it or not, it's in their blood. And they're saying, hey, it was our daddy that was firstborn. This isn't yours. But it was given to Israel. And so they're claiming to be Israel. The imposters of Revelations 2:9 and 3:9 claiming to be Israel. It's genetic. That was theirs. It was rightfully theirs. Their daddy was firstborn. And everything in the nation today is understood in that. Man, if nothing proved that to you. And listen, 9/11, there's still an opportunity. It's still news. If nothing else can prove to our people that this message makes a difference, what happened on 9/11 certainly should. Because if our nation wasn't incorrectly identifying the wrong people and supporting the wrong people, that would have never happened. All right, back on point here. Oh, here's another even more, what I consider an even more interesting connection between today's Jews and the Edomites. And one, in fact, that occurs every single day over in Jerusalem. Jerusalem celebrated Jewish Western, or what's called the Wailing Wall, is one of today's Jews' most sacred sites, right? However, contrary to what most people believe, the wall is not what's left of King Solomon's Israelite temple, but what's left of King Herod's Edomite temple. Now, isn't that amazing? New Standard Jewish Encyclopedia. Don't have to believe me on this. Under the Western or Wailing Wall, 1966 is when it was published, pages 1908 on 1909. Part of the wall enclosing Herod's temple is still standing in the old city of Jerusalem. The five lower courses date from the time of Herod. This part of the wall is regarded as sacred. This part of the wall is regarded as sacred in popular legend as far back as the Talmudic period, since at least the 10th century regular services were held before it and continue every day today. Now, being Edomites, it would seem that today's Jews intuitively know that it's Herod's temple, not Solomon's, that's their rightful shrine. The majority of today's Jews simply do not represent Israelites. Are there some? I suspect so. I suspect that there was some of back in Jerusalem, back in the first few centuries, that got mixed up with the wrong people. You know it happened from John Hycranius for a while. I don't think there's a lot. We know there's not a lot because the majority of go back to the Khazars. Are there some? I think there probably are some. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that maybe Benjamin Friedman was one and didn't know it. Or some of these others have been honest and open and told the truth. But the majority, there is no question, are not Israelites. So, that of course then going to lead us to the next question. Who then does represent the Israelites today? Think about this. Because the Gentiles, and I know you know who they are, and I know that you know different ways to do it, but I'm going to hopefully maybe present a couple different ways, or at least one of a couple here that possibly are a new way of maybe presenting this to others. Because the Gentiles in the Bible are usually misidentified, right? It is inevitable, because the Gentiles in the Bible, those who are the nations of Israel, are usually misidentified in the Bible. It is therefore inevitable that today's descendants of those same Israelites are also misidentified, right? It's like, you could say, like father, like son. Or in other words, let's put it this way. Yesterday's muddy waters have muddied today's water. They haven't got people identified correctly in the Bible, and so the descendants of those same people today have to be also incorrectly misidentified. On the other hand, flip the coin around, and if a person correctly identifies the Gentiles in the Bible, it becomes relatively easy then to correctly identify their descendants. Certain Gentiles in the Bible have already been identified as Israelites, which would mean then that the descendants of those Gentiles everybody thought was non-Israelites then must be Israelites as well. And it's easily proven from the Bible. Now we're going to patch a couple things together here. Let me begin with that Yahweh vowed once again in Jeremiah 31, 31 through 37 that he would have a relationship with Israel forever. I read it before, I won't read it again, but it's again the prophecy about the covenant that he would make, the new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And he then goes on, don't stop there, go on to the next few verses, because he says, as long as the sun rules by day and the moon rules by night, I will have a relationship, I'm paraphrasing, have a relationship with my people Israel. And he said, he also said, thus saith Yahweh, if the heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off the seed of Israel for all that they have done. Now, the sun still continues to rule by day, does it not? The moon still rules by night. The heavens have yet to be measured. In fact, every time they come up with a new telescope, they find out just how much further it goes. I don't think they'll ever find the end of it. I think it's infinite. Just like our God. And that's the promise that he made with his people, an infinite covenant to always have a relationship with them. The heavens haven't yet been measured, and the earth hasn't yet been searched out beneath. In fact, some people say there's been less searched out in the earth than there have in the heavens. And therefore, if God is true to His word, the descendants of the house of Israel, first of all, must still exist today. Furthermore, because Yahweh is always true to His word. Is He not? He said in that passage, "And I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." First of all, they have to still exist. They haven't been amalgamated. They may have disappeared. They may not know who they are. The rest of the nations may not have them identified. But God knows who they are. They still exist. And since they exist, and God is true to His word, then it simply has been Israelites with whom the new covenant has been made, just as He promised. Now, a good portion of God's covenant people is dealing with different biblical identifying marks of Israel. But this is my favorite, because this one alone absolutely seals puts the lid on it, hammers it down, and bends over the nails. Because again, God is either a liar, and you might as well throw out the old Bible, or the people to whom today, take a globe and draw, as others have said, and take a globe and draw circles around the nations over the last 2,000 years who have most readily embraced the new covenant religion of Christianity and been receptive of the gospel call of Yeshua the Christ. And you found the people. Now whether you know archaeology or whether you know history or not, that proves it. You don't have to prove it by archaeology. Can it be proven by archaeology? You bet it can. Can it be proven by history? You bet it can. More importantly, it's proven by that one statement of Jeremiah's alone, that he would make the new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. We have to be the people. Don't ever question it. Don't ever doubt it. Of course, we'll get to that in a minute. More to the point, though. Back to the previous point. People of Celtic, Germanic, Scandinavian, and Anglo-Saxon descent have considered themselves to be, all of these years, the descendants of who? What? No, I'm talking about as a whole, not talking about churches like this, but as a whole, who have the Celto-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian kindred peoples considered themselves to be descendants of? Who does the rest of the churches believe that they're descendants of? Japheth, let's not get that technical. Of the Gentiles that have been now identified in the Bible as of the nations of the house of Israel. Now, can you see how you can use that to say, if you can get some of the basics through the head and say, wait a minute, ethnos and goyim are not the exclusive terms that you think they are. They're generic terms meaning simply nations. And here are cases where those terms are used for the house of Israel. And these are the people that you think you're descendants of when you thought they were non-Israelites. Therefore, if those people are Israelites, then you must be an Israelite. You know, to show you how fogged over our people are. My sister was into this message, and up in Lander, they were involved with the Church of Christ initially. And there was a lady in the church who had taken her heritage and taken it all the way back to King David. She had it all out, evidence, you could trace it all the way back. And I've known of others, I guess Richard Hoskins can do something similar to that. And others have done it, but this lady had done it. She had all the evidence there. And you know that it never dawned on her that that made her an Israelite. my sister said, well, that makes you an Israelite. Of course, my sister had plans for that. And so he goes, yeah, it does. You know, again, we've got to be the specialists to do some prompting, some knocking on those thick skulls like somebody did with us, and help our people to wake up. I don't think it's that they don't want. Some people don't want to know. Again, brush off your feet and go find somebody who does. There's a lot of people who want to know. They just got to have somebody knock. Help them to find it, just like somebody did with us. So accordingly, if that's the case, today's Celto-Saxons and related peoples, therefore, again, must be Israelites. Just again, trying to share some different ways that you can share this with people that you may not have thought of. And either, again, the Celto-Saxon and related peoples are Israel, most importantly. If they're not, then God has not been true to His word, and He has made the new covenant with someone with whom He never promised to do so. That's a very powerful, powerful means of helping them to see. I think it is anyway. Of course, over the last 2,000 years, it's been the Celto-Saxon peoples that have been most readily embraced the new covenant and that call of Yahshua. In fact, we know this too, and that is that if it hadn't been for the Celto-Saxon people's proliferation of the New Covenant message, the rest of the nations would have never known about it, except for the Jews, who have completely rejected it. Armed with that information, with a lot of information that I've shared with you and that you've gathered in different places yourselves, it should come as no surprise, and certainly doesn't for us, that the majority of today's Jews who admit in their encyclopedias, their almanacs, through their historians, their anthropologists, that they are not the genetic descendants of either the house of Israel or the house of Judah, that they fit very few of the biblical marks of the nation of Israel as found in the Bible. In fact, today's Jews often epitomize the very antithesis of those marks. Not all of them, but certainly a majority of them. On the other hand, and as would be expected, the Celto-Saxons and related peoples fulfill every other biblical mark of the nation of Israel, corroborated, by archaeology and history alike. Again, don't give it all to them. You know, in fact, I suggest that if you've got somebody, if you've been blessed in some fashion with God's covenant people, don't give some guy fresh out of the chutes that book. It's too much. Our people aren't prepared for that. You got to hook them. That's why I wrote the tract, Could You Be an Israelite and Not Know It? That's why I've written the booklet, Israel's Identity, It Matters. And start with something real simple and real small and hook them. Start with one identifying mark. The new covenant was made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Therefore, God has to be true to His word, and therefore, we have to be Israel. And then say, get them hooked on that, and then take them and say, hey, they were to become a multitude of nations. They were to become a great and mighty nation. And all the other marks. And that just becomes corroborating evidence of something you've already got them hooked on. But far too often we try to give them what I've given you in these two messages, which is far too much to even do in this kind of setting, even with you. But isn't our God great? Isn't He great? And I'll tell you what, again, let me emphasize, we don't deserve to know what we know. To have been chosen as the ones to have our eyes open and our ears open to hear and to see what we see. My goodness, I know I don't deserve that. You know, I tell people, any opportunity I get, if you see any good come from this guy, you realize it's him. Because you may not have known me before he touched my life, but I did. And any good that's in this guy is him. How good he has been to choose us. Now, I think if he's chosen us, He also expects us to bless us with the knowledge and understanding of this area that we have knowledge and understanding of. Don't you expect that He expects us to do something with it? Once again, it's my desire in this message, with these two messages, to kind of rekindle the old flames in some of us. Some of you may be new, and I hope it's got you excited, but if you've been around for a while, and I've been around for a little while too, and I need to have it rekindled time and again with me as well. And it's been exciting. It's been exciting for me to do this. I haven't preached on this for a while, you know, in this much detail. And it's good to go back to the foundations and get excited again, and know that these are the foundations upon which the rest of the house is built. This is the foundations, of course, understanding that it's first and foremost in Christ. But in Christ, these are the foundations of not only the house, but the kingdom. Dominion here on earth, taking back from our enemies what at this point we've handed over to them on the silver platter. People say, if this is the kingdom, who wants it? Well, let me tell you, it's not God's fault the kingdom's in the condition it is. It's ours. We've handed it to them on a silver platter. We need to do everything we can to take it back. Amen? If not for our sake, and for our children's sake, and our children's children. Thank you. You've put up with me a lot of material and stuff that you've heard before, and I really appreciate being able to be here, and again, look forward to possibly doing it again sometime somewhere else. Thank you very much.
got to be more than efficient, we got to be effective. As the preacher says in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, a sharp knife works better than a dull one. And I think Ted has given us some sharp knives, some ways to be efficient, some ways to... You know, you're talking about something that is the most important thing there is. Eternal things far outweigh anything of this earth. And we're dealing with things of eternal substance. The kingdom's going to be forever. And we need to have to be wise stewards of the time He's given us. Use what He gives us the most efficient way possible. He's given us skills. He expects us to develop them. He doesn't expect us just to go up and say some. We say it the most effective way. We try to gauge where this person is, and then we try to come to his level to communicate with him. Because if there's no communication, it does not. You haven't done a thing. Our words and actions and deeds are supposed to have an impact on people around us. Things that we say and do are supposed to make a difference in somebody else's life. I really appreciate these two messages because it kind of renews my view. I mean, here we are. We're struggling to deliver a message that has salvation in it, and it'll, you know, if there's national repentance, it'll turn the nation around. Didn't God say that if my people would turn from me, turn back to me who are called by my name, He could heal this whole... You know, you look at the mess that's coming on us, and it looks... Oh, man, it's hopeless. Well, you know, God could heal that in a heartbeat. And it'll take some judgment to get repentance. But I really appreciated those messages because we need to do this from time to time, every 3 or 4 months. Go back and refresh the foundation. Clean off the foundation. Check it out. And you always learn something deeper. I'm not a guy that I learned something one time in my life and I know it and I can go on. No, I got to go back and grow deeper in everything that I've learned. This is the message that changed my life in a little motel room somewhere in southern Indiana years ago. I've always been a Bible reader and I've always been puzzled by some inconsistencies I couldn't quite identify, but just didn't sound right. But I've always been a Bible reader, and I've read the Bible over and over and over. And, you know, I floundered around. I tried different avenues of theology. And nothing ever quite made sense until one night in a motel room, an old man told me the story of who the nations of Israel are in the modern world and why it mattered. My life never been the same. Would you come up and give us a hymn for closing and a closing prayer? And Ted, thank you so much. Yeah, closing hymn and then...